Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Tortoise.
Hello, it's James. Good to be back. It's Monday, the 22nd of April. From Tortoise, welcome to the news meeting.
After 6 months of wrangling, the House has passed $95 billion in aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan.
The head of Israel's military intelligence unit has resigned for failing to prevent the Hamas terror attack.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
What's going on right here should never be happening. It's a very, very sad day in America, I can tell you that.
And this time, she's going to win London in incredible style, and it's going to be a new women's only world record. Jack Churchill is the champion.
There is a fair amount going on in the world, and to try and make sense of what really should be leading the news, I'm joined by Kat Nealon, Tortoise's political editor.
Hello.
And by Stephen Armstrong, who reports on so much for us, not least the whole wonderful world of culture.
Hello.
And Will Hutton is here. He is the former editor of The Observer. He's got a new book out called This Time, No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain. Hello, Will.
Glad to be here.
Right, let's try and think through what should be leading the news. I'm going to lock Will in this podcast studio when we're done so that we can have a proper discussion about This Time, No Mistakes, and try and figure out if there is a path to restoring growth, prosperity, lightness and joy to the United Kingdom. But there's no prospect of that in the course of this podcast. Let's get stuck into what we think should lead the news. Long story short, Kat, what's yours?
Mine is All Eyes on July.
Intriguing. Stephen?
This is incredibly difficult. I wish I didn't have to pitch it, but it's important.
That's not even a strap line. Will?
Well, I think one of the great events of 2024 is going to be happen tomorrow in Washington.
Oh, okay. Fantastically teasing, enticing, intriguing leads. Kat, why don't you start?
My long story short actually has changed. It was originally going to be Showdown for Sunak. It's now All Eyes on July because Rishi Sunak has this morning given a press conference about the Rwanda bill, which is snarled up in legislative ping pong, as we call it, when it goes back and forth between the Commons and the Lords. And rather than actually deal with the issues of getting this piece of legislation over the line, which we do expect to happen. I mean, he said on Friday, and he repeated it again this morning, that MPs and peers will sit and get it done. No ifs, no buts. Come what may, it will be passed either tonight or very early tomorrow morning. So he didn't deal with the nub of that, which I can come on to if you'd like. But instead, what he did this morning was actually set out the level of preparation that has been going on behind the scenes in order to make the Rwanda policy a reality. And I thought it was very interesting. So firstly, he has given a timeline, which is why it's All Eyes on July. He says he's now working on a timeline of 10 to 12 weeks for it to be operationalised, which gets us into mid-July. And eagle-eyed listeners might notice that July is also the date that is now being talked about as perhaps a general election.
So can we just stop there for a second, Kat? I have to confess, I'm one of those people who thinks that the Westminster parlour game of will he, won't he, after the May elections, will he, won't he, in July, is largely a waste of time, that it will be either October or November.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you.
Is that the most likely scenario still, do you think?
Well, he was asked about it in the press conference and he stuck to his second half of the year line, but July is in the second half of the year, so, you know, it's not impossible. I think the sort of stubborn inflation making interest rate cuts less likely or pushing them further back into the year probably will have a bearing, because every month that you go on as things stand, you have more people ticking off their lower rate mortgage onto a much higher rate mortgage, paying hundreds of pounds more a month. So all of this talk about people feeling better off is actually kind of at odds with most people's experience of what's happening. And so the kind of the benefit of going longer is that you have interest rate cuts and you have an improved economy. But actually, if we're not talking about interest rates being cut until November, there's no benefit.
And just talk through what you think the Sunak calculation is here, because there was an interesting exchange the last few days. A room of people was asked, did they think that even if effective, the Rwandan asylum policy would have an impact on the small boats? And the vast majority of people said no. So there is a version of which you say, the Rwanda policy is not going to make a difference to small boats. Small boats is really not going to make a big difference to an election that's much more based on cost of living and public services. This is a very, very curious thing for a prime minister to expend so much capital on if it's not going to move the dial politically.
Yeah, and the reason why they wanted it to happen before now is because we are now very much in the start of the small boat season. When the weather improves, you see more small boats. So if it doesn't happen in July, you will be seeing probably daily numbers in and around the 1,000 a day level. And that is just a reminder that it is yet another of his pledges that he did not fix.
Will, what do you think of all of this? Is this just Westminster noise?
You know, the population of Africa will be 2.5 billion in 2050. And all the migration specialists say that 3% of the population moves beyond its borders. You know, when 3% of the African population in 2050 moves beyond its borders, then they usually go to an adjacent country, not to, to another continent. But some proportion will come to, will try to come to the European Union and to Britain. You know, it's big numbers. And actually, no civilization can kind of take kind of inflows of that type, and imagining that the Rwanda bill is going to kind of and is going to deter them is kind of so stupendously ridiculous that I can't even begin to kind of get my brain around it. You know, one has to have some kind of massive program of kind of aid to kind of these states which are collapsing, to kind of try and stem the flow of a source. You have to try and have some kind of continental response to it, so that the, there's a lot of stuff here to be done, and it's not, you know, and I just think hearing, Mitchell on the radio this morning kind of peddling out this line and appealing to a kind of narrow base of kind of right-wing activists, and the rest of us kind of look on kind of thinking, well, what would we do? You know, I think the centre of gravity of this is completely wrong. Stephen?
I mean, I think that the Conservative Party is in a very interesting and difficult position in that it is essentially an anti-immigration party at this stage. It came in on the 2019 on a, secure the borders, close things down. It has overseen an enormous rise in immigration. I mean, immigration now into the UK is much higher than it was.
Although, in fairness, part of that is Hong Kong and part of that is Ukraine. And, there's all kinds of other stuff going on.
But so what do you do if you're an anti-immigration party and you've allowed massive immigration? Well, you focus very hard on one tiny, tiny thing and you make an enormous amount of noise about that one thing to distract from what's really going on, which is our borders are more open than ever before. We're letting more people in. It's benefiting our economy. It's benefiting our society. It's a very good thing. There's a great piece in The Economist recently about how good the British are at absorbing immigration and how all over the UK, people settle. It's fine. So how do you fight an election on immigration when that's the country you're overseeing? Well, you find this group of people who are kind of very visible, and then you have an enormous row about it for a very long time. I would argue that the Lords' resistance is actually doing the Conservative Party an enormous amount of good because they can portray themselves as struggling and victimised. And so the whole thing is kind of a piece of political theatre.
Can I ask you, Kat, just as a political reporter, what happens when you sit in those press conferences and you think, we're talking about the wrong thing here? Public support or public concern, I should say, about the NHS is as high as I can remember it. Mm. You feel as though in those press conferences you're there on behalf of the readers or listeners or public you're there to serve. And yet this conversation is set and the parameters of it are set by the Prime Minister wanting to have a discussion about Rwanda. Is there a way of kind of like wrestling back the agenda?
Yeah, I mean, the only way to do it is to ask the question that you want to ask. You know, and some people did ask off-topic questions, but they tend to be quite short-termist. So there's questions about Sir Mark Rowley and, you know, whether Rishi Sunak might look to leave the ECHR if this doesn't work. So there were sort of a handful of questions that were asked that were sort of tangential or different. But, you know, you kind of remember at the time, it felt totally fair, but in hindsight, it looks bananas that Boris Johnson was giving a press conference about the rising threats towards Ukraine from Russia. And the first question was about, I think it was about Chris Pincher or about Partygate, it was about domestic politics, which feels very small in the kind of bigger scheme. So, you know, journalists are humans and we sometimes make the wrong calls on questions to ask.
Humans?
Yeah. Just about.
Well, let's see whether we could work out what the right question to ask is, what the right subject to focus is. Will, what you said, you think one of the biggest stories of 2024 is going to be, if you like, answered or addressed this week. What do
That's
you mean
right.
By that?
What I mean by that is that on Saturday night, the Speaker of the House of Representatives finally, in an extraordinary vote fast, because he's a man of the right and was put there by the right of the Republican Party not to do this, actually brought four bills to the floor of the House, one of which was a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine, which passed massively, actually 3-1 majority. And I think the word is that the Senate will pass it, will reinforce that, pass that through, and that Biden will sign it into law tomorrow. And I think that that money, part of which is going to be used to replenish diminished American stocks of missiles and bullets, and part of which is going to go straight to Ukraine, kind of an imperative, really, if you believe as I do, that actually Ukraine must hold. And actually the six-month delay has cost, I mean, it really has, the momentum of the war has actually swung decisively, not decisively, it's too strong a word, but it's certainly swung in Russia's favour. They've made ground, the Ukrainians have given up ground. They just haven't got the kind of armaments to resist, and certainly they need to strike behind enemy lines with longer-range missiles in order to affect their logistics and all the rest of it, which they can't do. I mean, it's really, they've lost ground. It's just, and with the hope is they can now hold ground.
Kat, this is right, isn't it? Congress's approval of this package is the key story of the week, isn't it? The West has swung back in favour of Ukraine.
There are two huge wars happening at the minute which dominate everything, and for a long time we have been very focused on Israel Gaza, and Ukraine has somewhat played second fiddle to that in the sort of news agenda. But I think there has been this kind of rumbling in the background around the lack of resources, and obviously we've seen David Cameron go over to America a couple of times to try and break the deadlock and get this aid over the line.
I think it was brave by Cameron, actually, and he may have actually moved the dial a fraction.
Yeah, I think there's some suggestion, although the visit that he made earlier this month was sort of initially viewed as having been a bit of a failure. There is some suggestion that perhaps he may have prevailed on Donald Trump, yeah, who may have then been the sort of person that made the kind of difference in this matter.
There is an incredible mystery there, by the way, isn't there? The visit to Mar-a-Lago by Cameron, the refusal by Mike Johnson, the Speaker, to see him, and then within a matter of days, really, Johnson's 180 and support for Ukraine package. I'm not saying that the UK Foreign Secretary, you know, changed their calculations, but we really don't understand why Donald Trump and Mike Johnson, who, as you say, Will, had resisted this for 6 months, changed their view.
It was not a good look, allowing the Russians to overrun Ukraine in the run-up to a presidential election and you being blamed for it. The reaction in the States, and outside, you know, on Capitol Hill, there were kind of cheers when the votes went through. American public opinion is kind of There is a minority that is a kind of America first, you know, look after our own, you know. But I think the line that Michael Johnson used, that, you know, I'd rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys, and we can't have Russian tanks in Poland and then under the Baltic states, was one that actually resonated. So there was, and I think he couldn't be seen to see Cameron, and then days later, I kind of buckled under foreign pressure. He couldn't do that. By the way, I do think the indispensable kind of nature. It is true, by the way, the Europeans have given more absolute money to Ukraine. It's almost all of it, financial assistance. I mean, the military assistance from the Americans is imperative. And when you read what they can do, the amount of military kit they can move from this logistics center buried in rural Illinois. They know every railway head, every port. You know, they know where kind of every truck is in the world to move this stuff. It's kind of incredible, you know, and their capacity to kind of ramping up production of, you know, these kind of 155 millimeter shells. So they're going to produce next year 100,000 a month. These are kind of vast shells. You know, their capacity and the necessity of their engagement, you know, and we need them as the world's policemen, you know, and all that, you know, thank God they've re-engaged. I mean, that's why I regard it as important. It's bipartisan. They've re-engaged. The scale of their commitment is considerable. I think they will allow the Ukrainians, in terms of morale and sooner rather than later, the kind of capacity to resist the Russians. So I think ticks all those kind of boxes.
Stephen?
I mean, I think that this is potentially enormously interesting week in the concept of what Trumpism and MAGA is as an idea. So what we have is Trump himself is in court now for another 5 weeks. And over the first week, you saw him gradually, if you like, deteriorate. He began the first few days, he'd come in very confidently doing the photo calls. By the end, the final photo calls were of a very tired, very haggard man. He cancelled a lot of his rallies. So where does Trumpism exist if Mr. Trump is now locked away in the court, disappearing from the view? Well, it exists in the Republicans in the House of Representatives. And what I thought was intriguing was that Marjorie Taylor Greene's attempt or bluster that now is the time to get rid of Johnson is going nowhere. I mean, this feels like I think of America as having this strange tolerance for demagoguery up to a point. And I think there are sometimes in America moments where things just pivot on a dime. And I don't know if this is it.
Sorry, I did also wonder whether because Biden has taken the position of sort of non-interventionism, you know, withdrawing from Afghanistan and so on, whether there is a bit of politicking going on. And it would almost be more of a sort of natural sort of battleground for the Republicans to be on, a bit more sort of hawkish and sort of, you know, kind of looking at the sort of America as the kind of world's policeman type thing. So, you know, whether that is more them kind of going back into their natural ground more, and whether there's kind of a more strategic thing rather than, you know, just this kind of pivoting. I don't know.
Let's park that, take a moment, and then come, Stephen, to yours.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns. Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
What story are you wishing you didn't have to pitch, but pitching?
Gideon Falter and Sir Mark Rowley.
If you haven't followed every twist and turn of this story on social media, Gideon Falter is who?
He is the chief executive of a group called the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, which is pretty much what it says on Twitter.
And what happened?
So and this is why I think this is an important tortoise story. At one level, this is a relatively small story. But I think when you apply the context, the slow journalism, the thinking about what's going on, the question is, where does this story begin? To some degree, this story begins with the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism arriving at the Palestinian marches on a number of occasions. You know, at no point do I want to give the impression that there's anything about what I'm about to say that sets me against, that makes me anti-Semitic or sets me against the Jewish people. What has happened is that Gideon Falter, on last Saturday, came across, in his telling, a Palestinian march and attempted to cross the road where the march was taking place. A police officer prevented him from doing so. And in the course of his conversation, the conversation between these two people, the police officer said the phrase, "You are openly Jewish, and this is a... this may cause a problem if you go into the march." Now, Gideon Falter complained about this. There was a kerfuffle about it. And on Friday, just gone, the Metropolitan Police put out a statement which, in effect, implied that Gideon Falter was being provocative and that this would create tension and trouble. This was very, very badly worded. And on top of the phrase "openly Jewish," created a very, very ugly scene, in effect. And Gideon Falter has now called for the resignation of Sir Mark Rowley,
the Met Police Commissioner. Yes. Just run us through the wording of the statement.
Well, the key phrase is, "They must know their presence is provocative."
This was the Friday statement from the Met.
Yeah, and which has since been withdrawn and a much more fulsome apology issued. So why is this more than a particular thing? And I think there's a lot of things this plays into. For one thing, it goes into what we were talking about a little bit about earlier, is that there is a discussion taking place in and around the politicking of the UK, which I think a lot of people are sort of divorced from. We are at a time when there was two polls over the weekend. In the Times, 37% of the public do not believe the police are doing a good job. So the police clearly badly mishandled this situation. Also, an Observer poll showed that the public is not interested in culture wars and over politicking about identity. And so the British public don't really want to have certain kinds of conversations. It showed that phrases like "the woke mob is taking over" or "racist governments" reduced support for the party that was making them. So what we have is a very, very heightened discussion where people are coming in. You know, Suella Braverman's coming in supporting Gideon Falter in calling for Sir Mark Rowley to go. The question is, what really happened? We can't be sure. Sky News has released a much longer video than was initially released, where the police officer suggests to Gideon Falter that he could be escorted by police via a different route to go where he wants to go. And Gideon Falter is not keen on that outcome. Gideon Falter is the first person to raise the principle that the only way to stop me is to arrest me. And then another police officer says, "We are going to arrest you." What do we have? We have really a protest and a counter-protest. You could argue that the police's job is to keep these two groups separate. That is really the role of the police. And "openly Jewish" was an ugly phrase. So the question we need to think about is, what's the truth of this scenario? Everybody has made statements which are really hard to see through and understand. I think the smartest comment was from the Community Security Trust, which is a Jewish organisation which is about protecting the Jewish community. And they have, it's an underreported statement in my book, they talk about the situation. They say, "The CSC has worked with the police every day to protect Jewish communities from anti-Semitism and terrorism. We see the extra support the police have given to our community. We know why it's needed, and we know it's done with professionalism that everybody expects." They then question, how much longer will these costly and disruptive protests be allowed to continue? And I think this is where we start to get to the question. The question of this whole debate is, should we allow these protests to continue?
So hold on, Stephen, let's just go through it. So it seems to me as though what you're talking about is a four-tier, possibly five-tier story. So there is What happened at the protest itself? What happened in the statement that the Met then put out? Yes. The broader question about whether or not there should be the frequency or scale of protests, the wish by the campaign against anti-Semitism to make a political point about this, and the broader reverberations of this in the British public. So just taking each one at a time, let's start with the very first, actually what happened on the ground. You know, we're in a podcast studio. You can even hear us sometimes when there are kind of difficult subjects, struggling to get the right words, knowing that there are things that you should say and you shouldn't say. It's not unreasonable, is it, of a police officer who's dealing with a big protest, trying to figure out what the right thing is to say something that's not the right thing, and then be able to say, I'm sorry, I didn't get that wording right. But the intention was to avoid anything that was going to get nasty.
Yeah, and I think, for instance, if the police officer had said clearly instead of openly, it would have changed the tenor of the conversation.
And do you think there's anything in that moment, Kat, do you think there's anything in that moment where effectively, because the reason why I think, I should say, by the way, there's lots of throat clearing here, I am Jewish, I'm going home this evening to make matzo ball soup, so I've obviously got, you know, a whole set of, you know, emotions around this story. But journalistically, is there an issue, Kat, with a police officer essentially eliding Jews and Israel, which is, I think, part of Gideon Falter's point?
We were having a conversation before we came in about this because it is, as you say, a difficult topic and no one wants to sort of inadvertently say the wrong thing. I made a noise when Stephen was saying about if he'd have used the word clearly Jewish instead of openly Jewish. I actually don't think that that makes a huge amount of difference. I think the problem comes, and I think this is the problem, the issue that Gideon Falter has been making, in that what was the police officer protecting him from effectively was a likely encounter that could have been physically violent. And that, I think, is the issue that we're dealing with here. The question of whether someone is openly Jewish or openly pro-Israel, I think, is really, really difficult, because we know that there are Jewish people that go on these protests who are pro-Palestinian. And so That is a sort of layer of complexity that I don't think you can get into, and certainly not by how someone looks or what they're wearing.
But I do think, Stephen, you're right. I think the CST in this case, really interesting. So if you don't know that organisation, there's no reason why most listeners should. The fact that an organisation that is devoted to trying to protect Jewish communities and synagogues has actually come out and said, look, we work with the police, and in effect, we really appreciate the police's support, you know, day in, day out on the security side, I think significant. It does seem pretty obvious to me that this police officer got it wrong, in that it's one thing to be carrying a placard that might be provocative. It's another thing to be wearing a kippah or a yarmulke, and your Jewish identity being provocative. I just think there's a difference between what you say in the moment when you're trying to deal with a, you know, difficult and uncertain situation, and then the second tier of this, which is what you then say in a statement the following Friday. So let's tuck into that for a second. That's where the police as an organisation tripped over its own shoelaces, didn't it? It didn't really think through what it was saying.
It's, I mean, the a lot of the reporting on that statement, including in the Guardian, which does come with, you know, all of the trouble is with this is that you can't find a single report on this that doesn't have an axe to grind. There is no part of the British media that is neutral or independent on this story.
Which, by the way, Stephen, is an incredible moment, because I don't remember a story for a long time, you know, even if you go back to the Iraq War, people had points of view, but it wasn't necessarily as communal, as divided. Everyone clears their throats before they get to talking about it. There's an assumption that journalists can't have a journalistic interrogation or judgment on a story. Everyone, the assumption is everyone's baggage is part of the telling of it. But sorry, go on.
So the statement, in a way, pointed to the continued presence of Gideon Falter and the campaign against anti-Semitism at the Palestinian marches, and therefore implied that his presence was a provocation, and that he knew that his presence was a provocative thing to do. Now, that may or may not be true. But, I mean, the problem we have is that we're trying to determine intention. I mean, that's us, our problem as journalists, is we are trying to determine the intention of Gideon Falter and the intention of the police officer on the ground. In that conversation, there are two people, and we have a transcript of, or video recording of their exchange, but we don't know what they intended to do next.
Well, what do you think? What do you think of these first two phases of the story?
Well, first of all, I have to say, it's been rather a privilege to kind of watch you three on Tortoise Media, kind of, you know, try and think your way through this. I mean, I, if every newsroom was as kind of considered and reflective, British news coverage would be better for it. So just to say that.
What do you think about the principal issue that the CST raises? And actually, to be fair, has been an issue since mid-October and has really divided politicians and, I think, fairly some of the public around the frequency and scale of the marches. You know, when we've had this conversation in this newsroom, our argument has always been squarely in favour of public protest, public dissent, much better that than suffocating it and all the consequences that come with that. But do you think that something is shifting in what you mentioned, Stephen, in terms of public weariness with the protests?
I mean, I think there's a number of ways to answer that. One of those ways is to say that I didn't know there was a march that Saturday until Gideon Falter issued his statements and we had the Metropolitan Police.
And actually, James, you mentioned the Iraq war earlier. You know, I remember obviously the first protest was absolutely huge, but they kind of petered out fairly quickly. There were some protests that went on for a long time, but eventually it was just a handful of people standing in the rain. And I think that that is probably the better way to deal with the situation, is to allow people to continue rather than to try and stop it or regulate it, because then you have more reason for people to protest.
Will, can I ask you what you think about the way in which the media meets a story like this? I'll confess, I'm really saddened by it, because I think that any moment where I see essentially the hatreds and the anger and the fear and the grief being generated out of what's happening in Israel, Gaza, being imported into UK public life, and whether that's the BBC or the police or schools, I really ask myself whether it's necessary, whether or not we're importing arguments and we're creating divisions. And yet, of course, the media reports divisions. We report arguments. So do you think that we've got any grip on the proportion of this story?
No, I share that view, by the way. I mean, I do think, I do think that, there's been a long-standing problem in Britain that, the media... it frames the public square. It's the pillar on which the public square kind of stands, but it shouldn't be an actor in the public square. And here, for a long time, kind of British newspapers have been, particularly on the right, not only on the right, the Guardian's not completely clean hands, but the right have become... right-wing newspapers the last 20 years have become more and more kind of actors in the public square as well as framing it. So here you have a case where actually, to be an actor in the public square has kind of knock-on effects and kind of our culture and generating kind of, as you say, kind of importing, the ferocity of kind of hatreds that, I would like to, I know in the book I've just written, I kind of argue for kind of revisiting Levinson, because I do think that actually the kind of conversation you guys are having should have been reproduced, particularly in our broadcast media. If you're putting something into the public domain, you should be very careful how you do it, and we're not. I've been wondering, what your view, collective view, is. I mean, I thought the way Biden handled the potential kind of escalation of conflict in what was Israel's response going to be to Iran? I mean, the line he took was, we will defend, your airspace if they attack you. But if you decide to attack them, you're on your own. For the first time almost, actually, since the war began. Is there a kind of an analogy to here? I'm not sure
there
it works.
There is an
analogy. We defend, but we don't support your right to attack.
Yes, exactly. We defend. So exactly. So, you've been differentiating the CST, which is kind of, I know one or two people used to serve in the police, and they're kind of, there's been an absolute collapse in morale. There's a sense that no one stands up for them. that actually they're trying their bloody hardest in a very difficult car. And it should be said, you know, and I'm glad that the CSTO have come out with that statement. It's really important to say that, actually. I mean,
there's a particular line in the statement that I think is worth actually stressing. I didn't say the first time round, which is where the CSTO say an individual officer tried to do the right thing, but ended up making things worse in a very difficult moment. And I think that is as neat an encapsulation of the story as there's been.
And I keep going back to the ways in which we think about this story that has sort of a human heart to it. And that statement has that moment going, okay, I know they were trying to do the right thing and did the wrong one. You know, there's just something about that and how we capture that.
Just one more point on the politics of this, because, of course, there is also the fact that there is a local election coming. The, you know, London mayor is being hammered by the Tories. You know, we haven't seen any current serving ministers call for Mark Rowley to go. The Home Secretary is having a meeting with him today. There's pressure being applied, but it's not unhelpful, I should think, to have some sort of conservative attack dogs sort of applying some pressure and reminding everyone that it's Sadiq Khan that's in charge of the police commissioner's future. So I think there is probably a degree of that at play as well, which is the opposite end of the spectrum to the sort of, us kind of thinking that the CST has taken the right approach.
Well, let's try and figure out what we think really should be leading the news. Will, there's a kind of loosely enforced rule here, which is you can't plug your own story. So you have to plug someone else's. If it weren't Ukraine, what would you lead on?
So I would go, you know, with Rwanda. It will be the news tonight, you know, and July and all of that. You know, you've got to do that. And
then go, Stephen?
I would go for the Ukraine story, but I would add in the Trumpian elements, because I think that the Republican Party politicking is a critical part of that story.
I would also go with Will's story. But because I'm biased towards the UK, I would like to know a bit more about what happened with this Cameron, Trump, Mike Johnson triangle.
It's a great line to explore, isn't it? I have to confess, I think this is one of those news meetings where in the end it's quite easy. The $61 billion. $61 billion, a potential
saving
shift
Europe
in the balance.
Saving Europe from Putin is rather important. Come on, let's go with it.
Sticking a finger in the eye to Vladimir Putin. And as you say, though, you know, Stephen's point about what does it tell us about Trump, Johnson and the marginalisation of Marjorie Taylor Greene. Actually, the hard thing is what follows. Because, obviously, the Gideon Falter story is much more of a talker, as it's known. It's likely to generate much debate. But it is an incident involving one person that has been exploited, and you'd feel if you run it high, you'd be playing into that exploitation for political purposes, and it would rebound on you. So for that reason, I actually go with Rwanda, not because I think that a really significant thing is happening in British public policy, but because I think it shows you quite a lot about the calculation of Rishi Sunak. The running order would be Ukraine, Rwanda, the campaign against anti-Semitism. And on that, a big thank you to you, Kat Neal, Stephen Armstrong and Will Hutton. Thanks so much for coming in. We're going to tuck into a conversation about This Time No Mistakes. Do listen to that in a bonus episode on the news meeting. And I leave you with these joyous sounds, not runners, but the crowds at the London Marathon. You realise that that is as much a spectacle as the people who do that 26 miles or so.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence, call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
I'm David Baddiel. I'm a writer and a comedian and a Jew.
I'm Saida Varsi. I'm a businesswoman and a politician and a Muslim.
Jews and Muslims always seem to be in the news or on the news. Lots of people talk about us, and this is us talking about ourselves.
The kind of things that people say don't touch, yeah. We are going to go there.
I mean, I think Jews and Muslims are talking about these things, but I think they're not talking about them together because they're worried that if they do, sparks might fly. A Muslim and a Jew go there.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.